Beverly Moffitt sitting in for Mark Steiner, and you're listening to The Mark Steiner Show on your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. Recently, there was an article written by Jonathan Capehart in the Washington Post that caught my attention. It was entitled, How Ben Carson Cures White Fright in the Republican Party, which looked at the ways presidential candidate Ben Carson seems to appeal to a largely white Republican Party. I want to discuss this with my panel of guests today, but I'm going to first turn to someone who is actually quoted in that Washington Post article to discuss this phenomenon. The person I'm talking about is Dr. Leah Wright Rigger, who is an assistant professor of public policy at the Harvard Kennedy School, and she's also the author of the recent book, The Loneliness of the Black Republican, Pragmatic Politics and the Pursuit of Power. Good morning, Dr. Wright Rigger.
Good morning.
Thank you so much for joining us, and we were so glad to be able to have you join this conversation, especially since you seem to be that expert voice that was in Jonathan Capehart's article. And so to be able to hear your voice to add or lend or even help shape this conversation for us was quite a coup for me. So I'm so glad that you're able to join us this morning.
Well, thanks for having me.
So I'll let you talk. I mean, this article came across my Twitter feed and caught my attention immediately. And I thought this would be an interesting conversation to hear what it is that is making Ben Carson's rise in the polls in particular really interesting. We know that we've seen Donald Trump seeming to command what many of the polls say right now in terms of being the front runner. But interestingly enough, then you have Ben Carson that seems to be this close second, and they are very different candidates.
Very different.
So talk to us about how you see them different and what it is about Ben Carson's rise to success so far.
Well, I think that the thing that jumps out to me immediately about Ben Carson is how soft-spoken he is, especially in comparison to Trump, right? So Trump, we've seen kind of all over the news being brash, being loud, kind of being incredibly aggressive, and in fact, a level of aggressiveness that we haven't seen in any kind of political candidates in the United States in a very long time.
Right.
Ben Carson is very much the doctor. And I think people trust doctors. They also trust the fact that he's soft-spoken, he comes off as approachable, he comes off as comfortable, and they like that. And I think it also ties up into this idea of what he represents. Right? So he's religious. He's incredibly religious. And in fact, today, I think either last night or early today, he challenged Trump's credentials on religion. Right? He said, I really doubt that he's, you know, a faithful man. And in fact, Carson rises to political prominence by calling out Barack Obama at the National Prayer Breakfast.
Right.
So there's that element too, and I think we can't understate that. But then there's another element of Carson that I think people like, in particular conservatives. And I mentioned in that piece with Jonathan that Carson is rising in popularity at the same time that Black Lives Matter is gaining in prominence, prominence, right? So it's becoming a household name. And I don't think that's any mistake. Carson, in a way, is incredibly safe.
Absolutely.
He is the antithesis of, you know, this kind of broad, amorphous Black Lives Matters group. And I think people pick up on that. And we can't forget that he's willing to go, you know, to criticize very, you know, in a very deep way, the Black Lives Matters movement and kind of anti-police brutality movement. And so for Carson, racism, which he does acknowledge exists, racism is a thing to be cured through individual acts.
Right.
Through love and I'm not racist and I'm not going to do racist things. Whereas for larger movements, black protest movements and movements like Black Lives Matters, racism is something that is structural.
Right.
It should be changed through structural means. And so I think for a lot of people who have problems with that, and, you know, it's intensely racialized, Carson represents something completely different and something where people can say, well, look, if he's saying it, then it must be true on matters of race.
Yeah, and one of the other points that I think gets raised in this article that you capture very well is also this whole notion of colorblindness, right? In terms of he is a raced body because he happens to be Black or African-American, but also the fact that if we can deal with the idea that colorblindness exists and we see it, or as Republicans, we can affirm it through this raced body, then that also means that we are not race or racist.
Right, exactly. So there's kind of this idea of the myth of colorblindness, which Carson is both engaging in and also separate from. Right. So he comes from a history, and this is intensely important to him. If you read his autobiography, being raised in a Black enclave, being raised with Black family members, doing his work in Baltimore. He gives speeches at historically Black colleges and universities. In 2004, I believe, he was the commencement speaker for Spelman College. So race is an intense part of who he is. But so, too, is the idea that, you know, if we just look beyond race, then we can overcome racism. Mm. And so I think there's something there. You know, there's a long tradition within African-American communities of this kind of, of this kind of conservative thought that is outside of partisanship. So even as, Ben Carson is claiming to be a Democrat many, many years ago, he's still engaging in this kind of, Black conservatism that has its roots, that has roots in Black communities, very long roots in Black communities.
That whole idea of presentability politics of that I, too, if I act this way, then I, too, can achieve greatness regardless of my particular racial category.
Right. If I just pull up my pants, if I just go to school, if I just get a Harvard education, if I do all of these things. And so it's this idea that Black humanity should be judged based on behavior.
Right.
You know, and we see this during the civil rights movement. We see this in Brown v. Board of Education, where they present, handpick children who can be, these respectable, citizens. We see this, with desegregation, where the children and the teenagers and the college students they choose are always, perfect or near perfect. Because the idea is if, we can show, hey, we're just like you and we behave and there's nothing to fear, then maybe people will give us our rights rather than the fact that just by virtue of,
being a human being,
we are deserving of rights.
Exactly.
I think that this is, it's not something that's unique to Republican politics. We also see, older generations kind of engage in this kind of everyday conservatism, or we see it in particular much more recently with Barack Obama, right?
And I wanted you to address that, because I know that you talk about or you quoted in the article making comparisons between Ben Carson and Edward Brooke, but I'm really curious about the comparison between Carson and Barack Obama.
Well, I think so. One of the things that Obama does is that he's much more invested in structural solutions, right? So that's where he, I think, falls much more on the liberal side of things. But in terms of individualism, accountability, personal responsibility, kind of this moral finesse, this is something that we see over and over again in Barack Obama's speeches, especially his speeches directed towards Black audiences. So we can think about his fatherhood speech. We can think especially the one, I'd like to point at is his speech to Morehouse graduates,
right,
where he says, race and racism are still important, but you're going to have to work harder. Nobody's going to hand it to you.
Right.
So there's this assumption that people are going to hand things to you. But it's this kind of idea that, pick yourself up, be presentable, be present, and these things will change. But I think that we see that irrespective of all of these things, all of these degrees, all of, how you carry yourself, what you look like, that doesn't necessarily rule out racism, right? We see that with James Blake, the tennis star, who was just, tackled by police.
Right.
even though he checks every single one of the respectable boxes.
And it still doesn't work in his favor.
Right. And, you know, he's out here bewildered saying, this shouldn't have happened to me. Well, actually what this demonstrates is that respectability can only take you so far.
That's right. That's right. So, Dr. Wright-Ruggiero, we've got to move on, and I want to make sure I hear the guests respond to your research and what you've contributed to this conversation this morning. So I want to thank you so much for joining us.
No problem. Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. So we've been talking to Dr. Leah Wright-Ruggiero, who is an assistant professor of public policy at the Harvard Kennedy School and also the author of the recent text, The Loneliness of the Black Republican, Pragmatic Politics and the Pursuit of Power. Thank you so much for joining us again. I now turn to our distinguished guests of panelists who are joining us to continue the conversation of Ben Carson and his calming effect on white voters. So I'm joined in the studio with Dr. Malia Cromer, who is the director of the Sarah T. Hughes Field Politics Center and also assistant professor in the Department of Political Science and International Relations right here at Goucher College. Good morning.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And then we also have Catalina Byrd, who is a familiar voice in the on WEAA, who is a media consultant and political strategist. And she's also a co-host of No Hooks for the Hip Hop Chronicles here on WEAA 88.9. Good morning, Catalina.
Good morning. How are you?
Well, thank you. And we also have with us via phone Andrea Plaid, who was named one of Ebony.com's 8 dynamic black women editors in new media. She is also contributing editor at The Feminist Wire, a critic for Kirkus Review, and the arts and culture editor for the award-winning Twin Cities Daily Planet. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
I am well. Thank you so much for all three of you joining us. We've got to take advantage of this moment when it is nothing but women sitting around the table offering their expertise and their sound advice of what is happening in national politics today. So I'm looking forward to hearing what you all have to say. I want to start with Dr. Cromer, who's in the studio with me, to get a response or feedback to what Dr. Wright-Ruggiero had to offer.
I think first and foremost, I'm very excited to read the book, and I look forward to assigning it, I think, next semester in one of my courses.
Great.
So I think about this in a lot of different ways, and with how Carson resonates, is to me, is people across the board love this narrative of the American dream, and I think Carson really encapsulates it a lot, because despite, and he can talk about this more so than other candidates, despite race, despite economic background, he is able to rise to be a neurosurgeon at Hopkins. And people really resonate with that. I think what's interesting about Carson is, and what you don't hear enough, is that not only is he the exception to the rule in a lot of cases, he's the exception to the exception to the rule. We're talking about any one of us, the difficulty of becoming a neurosurgeon. That's actually one of those positions where they try to weed you out early on right. to get to rise to this. So
or when you hear one say, you know, you're not a rocket scientist. I mean, that's that category.
It's
right?
that category. It's the you're a brain surgeon. What are you, a brain surgeon? Or are you a rocket scientist? So while it's an incredible story, it is not a typical story. And it is something to be achieved. But not all of us can become a brain surgeon. Not all of us have that intellectual capability or that dexterity to do it. So while it's a great narrative, I think it's just that exception to the rule that we haven't really kind of pushed back on him enough already with that.
Okay. And I want to interject very quickly. Don't forget to call in with your comments. We'd love to hear from you at 410-319-8888. You can also tweet us at Mark Steiner and comment on the Mark Steiner Facebook page or send us an email at talk@steinershow.org. Catalina, jump in. I'd love to hear your perspective on this.
Well, I echo the doctor's sentiment and can't wait to read the book because I was raised in a family of black Republicans and I don't think that they ever felt lonely. So that's an interesting perspective. And I'm from Baltimore. But, you know, I read that article that Jason wrote and Dr. Ruger, and it was interesting that they look at Ben Carson like that because the Republicans tried to do this with Michael Steele to kind of get ahead of the curve of having their own black conservative voice after the election of Barack Obama. And Michael was not soft-spoken in the way that Dr. Carson is. He's equally accomplished. He's the same American dream exception to the rule, while not maybe the exception to the exception. And so there's something to be said when Carson can pull more traction than a Michael Steele or Herman Cain. It's still, while they're talking about being colorblind, you have to be soft-spoken so that you don't look like the angry black man.
Right.
He says some very disparaging things, but he says them cool, calm, and collected as though he might be emotionless or removed in some kind of way. And I think that's where the beginning of his calming effect is. But they also would always love for us to have, and we always have had, people who are critical of ourselves. But I still agree with the doctor to a sense, too, that I don't think that we were raised to believe the older nonpartisan conservative part she was talking about respectability. It's not that we were raised that it keeps you safe or that it makes you an exception to the rule or helps you to succeed. It's just about the way that you present yourself and the pride that you show in the family that you come from. And so in that regard, I think that's why you hear the president making those kinds of comments at Morehouse and in his speeches about fatherhood, because those things are true. There is something to taking pride in yourself. And when you do, you present yourself in a way that's respectable and appropriate for the platforms that you're in.
Right. So that rises above political affiliation and just simply becomes about what's necessary in order to be seen as someone who can traverse or climb to the next level.
Right. People are always upset with me because they know, Mark, one of them, that I have natural hair underneath of the wigs that I wear on television. And I explained to them, you know, nobody else in the spaces that I'm in has a big curly afro. Will you listen to me if my hair is as big as my face? Will what I'm here for and what my platform is and what I'm trying to do for black women in media reach as many places? And will I go as far if I just say, well, you know what, you can't take me as I am, when I know that I can put on a wig and look like my other counterparts to at least to that degree in terms of presentation, to get where I need to go to present and represent for us the way that I want to.
Right, and that's clearly at the nexus of respectability politics and whether or not, I mean, there are multiple sides to that particular stance of if it's acceptable or not, or can we be authentic or not. But you're correct that it is clear that there is a particular way in which we are received if we decide to present ourselves in ways that are counter to what mainstream audiences are used to. And that's not an affirmation of either way or not, it's just simply acknowledging that I think you're quite accurate with that. I also think it's interesting that Ben Carson then becomes that person we see as accessible because he's more cerebral versus the more passionate black politician who is connecting to you almost from these religious depths that you feel connected to because he's speaking the way that you're most comfortable and he's utilizing those communication skills that resonate with black audiences. Whereas Ben Carson, because he's so cerebral, offers another perspective or take on it.
Yeah, I would agree totally because we had him on Square Off. I don't know if Mark was on that show or not. We had Dr. Carson on Square Off one time. And what it became clear is that his lack of legal understanding on having ever run a business, he couldn't find the way to take the cerebral out of his context to communicate differently. He struggled on the show with us because we were, as you know, Square Off, we talk about political issues and current events. And he couldn't find that connect. And I think that ultimately when it comes down and get closer to the primary, or if he in some kind of way pulls off the Hail Mary and wins the GOP nomination, it won't play well in debate. He's good at talking at people, like most really wonky smart people are, but he's not good at talking to people.
Right, and making those connections. So, Andrea, jump in. Yes. I'd love to hear your perspective on Dr. Ben Carson.
Well, I think that Dr. Ben Carson is... I appreciate his story, but I think what Carson, we need to talk about the fact that Carson, being an exception, has also exceptionalized himself. And in that way, that also makes white conservatives very comfortable. Because basically what he's saying is, I'm not like them. I'm not like those people over there. And we know what those people are code for. Mm. At the same time, I do feel a certain amount of compassion for Ben Carson because I also understand that his conservatism, based very deeply in black respectability politics, is also a way of coping with racism in this world. In the sense of, in much the same way that respectability politics itself is a way to cope in this racialized world, in this racist, not even racialized, racist world. So I understand where he's coming from. It's the same stance that Dwayne Johnson holds. He's very conservative. And he does it in such a way where there's a wink, there's a smile, muscles, he's handsome, all of that. But deep down, he was also very critical of the Black Lives Matter movement as too. So, but again, it's his way of coping. It's his way of saying, I know what the, I know this is stacked against me, but I'm going to get my hustle on, as much as I hate the word hustle, and try to get mine.
Yeah.
I mean, so I can understand where they're coming from. The problem is that I disagree with both of them on a moral level.
Right.
And I think that's where we need to say with Ben Carson and even the Dwayne Johnson, as much as I love him, we need to say that I just disagree with you. And even though Ben Carson presents it with a, you know, cool demeanor and a smile, he's also the opposite of the coonery. And I'm going to say the word coonery that was Herman Cain and his 999 foolishness. And also Michael Steele, who was, I don't know what buffoonery he was trying to pull, but it was so over the top and it was so comical to almost that he took himself out of the conversation because people were thinking, where is he coming from? However, when he left, what I also noticed is he looked rather shell-shocked when he left the RNC chairmanship. I think he finally got a taste and kind of saw how the sausage was made, as it were, on how the black, on how white conservatives and white Republicans in particular frame race and racism and how they kind of put, and how they put him out there. So again, I think that Ben Carson holds a very interesting, particular, but also a self-exceptionalizing place within the framework of this whole thing around blacks and respectability politics.
Continue.
No, I was going to say, and I just think that respectability politics, one of the byproducts can be that it does self-exceptionalize people. And again, Ben Carson is just, he's just an example of that.
I would agree.
He exceptionalizes, self-exceptionalizes himself with white conservatives.
Right. So let's take a, I know that Catalina has a response to what you just said, but I'm going to ask her to just try and hold on to it for a minute because the phone lines have lit up and we want to hear from some of our callers to add to the conversation. So first, if we can hear from Ernest on line three. Good morning, Ernest.
Good morning. My question is, why is it that Lieutenant Anthony Brown, an African-American man that has done everything, went to Harvard, served in the Air Force, went to Iraq, and did all the things that we ask our young people to do, our young black men to do, is not the governor of Maryland? And it's because of people like Catalina Byrd and other black people that is handpicked by white people that went against this man. And then they get all the play, all the say, and they work against us all the time. Now, they come on and say, well, I'm not a Republican. I'm an independent. But Victor Clark was a Republican. Your father was a Republican. And so you come on with this.
He still is.
Huh? That's what I'm saying. I know your father. I talked to him often. That's why I didn't vote for him. I knew your father. And they come on here, this guy, Dan Bongino, they pushed him out there. Listen to Dan Bongino on the radio, how racist he is all the time. They push this man. And these are the people that white folks pick, in my opinion, that cause us a lot of pain and problems. Now, when you say Dr. Carson does not have a chance to be president of the United States. In anybody's mind, this is a game that they play with us. This is the con that they run on us. And the reason why President Barack Obama was elected, he was very smooth. He was very smooth, very slick, and was well vetted. and was raised by white people. So they trusted Barack Obama, and he did exactly what he was supposed to do. He's the second coming of George W. Bush.
So, Ernest, if I can just get you to pause, because I want to give Catalina the opportunity to respond to that and an earlier comment that was made. So, Catalina, can you jump in for a minute?
Ernest and I have been having this conversation for years. He can continue to say that I've been handpicked by white people, but yet he's never met me, and he can't name the white people that selected me and tell me where they found me. I built my body of work, and I choose my candidates based off of and work for whom I believe in. Anthony Brown, while yes, he had gone to the military, had not shown in his 8 years as lieutenant governor to me, personally as a voter and a resident of Maryland, where he had the ability to be an effective leader for the state of Maryland. So I supported Doug Gansler, who I did feel like was willing to step out of line with the machine and fight for things that mattered to me, like banning the box and increasing penalties for people who commit domestic violence. But, you know, Ernest is of a generation where it doesn't matter what I say, I'm ever going to change their mind. He is entitled to his opinion. Some days we agree depending on what we're talking about, and some days we don't. Some days he's offensive and some days he's not. And, yes, my father is a Republican, so is my mother. They raised me, I think, I'd like to think, well, and I'm used to Ernest.
Okay. Well, I also have Clarence on the line, and so I want to hear what he has to say, because he does want to bring us back to the specific conversation of Ben Carson, so, Dr. Ben Carson. So, Clarence, could you join us?
Yes, thank you. You know, I really don't pay attention to people like Ben Carson when they start talking about racism, cause, effect, and so forth, because, you know, they really don't look at it from the perspective that I look at, which is personal. They don't address the issue of how racism is manifested in the physical space, the thought, and how it's allowed to be mass marketed. You can't take a scalpel and cut that out, okay? So, Mr. Carson, I'm looking at Germany now. You've got a degree in neurosurgery, and Merkel's sitting over there with a degree in physics. Okay, they have the largest one of the largest manufacturing bases on the planet right now. I think they're number three or number four, and they're doing it with manufacturing. What they've done is technically they've put their people back to work by using the current technology. They're sitting over there with these massive 3D printing facilities scattered out all over the country, like small businesses in America, and they're putting people to work. Maybe that's the reason why Germany can say, okay, we'll take 800,000 refugees in, because they can have an economic base. Do you think that you can put us on par with Germany so that they don't overtake us economically? And like, if you get an 8-year term, you know, I'm not interested in all that other nonsense, because racism, which that divisive thing that they've thrown in there, you know, that he talks about, that's just a smokescreen to keep us away from the real issue, which is putting all of these people back to work, particularly black people who have no jobs, and to somehow come up with a tax base to educate them. So, you know, he's like, okay, next. Thank you.
Thank you, Clarence. Always glad to hear your perspective on the show. So we need to take a break now, but this conversation has really generated some interest among our guests, as well as those of you calling in. So we want to come back or return to this topic when we return. But on our way to break, I want to remind you that the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, offering a full range of financial services. MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. More information at www.meq.com. Looking forward to continuing the conversation after the break. Welcome back. I'm Kimberly Moffitt, sitting in for Mark Steiner, and you're listening to The Mark Steiner Show on your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. So we do want we wanted an opportunity to talk about the Kentucky clerk, Kim Davis, who was jailed last week. But we want to continue the conversation on Dr. Ben Carson because we still have a number of callers who want to share their perspective. And I also wanted to return back to Dr. Cromer to have her offer a perspective in response to some of what we've heard thus far.
So I think a key thing that we've heard from both of the callers previously is this idea of electability. What is actual Carson's electability? So he's doing really well in the polls. But I think outside of maybe the American Dream narrative is also this desire, this really strong desire among Republicans for an outsider. So not only does Ben Carson have this undertone of racial issues that he can help punctuate among Republicans, he also fulfills this desire to have somebody who isn't part of the establishment. And not only that, one of the main criticisms that I think Republicans get really frustrated with is this idea that they're anti-intellectual of some sort. And he is the response to that. He's the quintessential response. You can't call Ben Carson anti-intellectual.
And so he ends up bottling up in one person for us, clearly the intellectual, but he's also the one that believes in this idea of religious liberty, too. Right.
He's an outsider. He believes in and he's a deeply religious person.
Yes.
And
yes.
This is the key thing for him to come at Trump with, because at the end of the day, Ben Carson has the religious chops to stand on far more than Donald Trump does.
Well, but Donald Trump says that he's very much a Christian and has a lot to offer in that category as well. But we can look in terms of pop culture to question some of that, at least in terms of how conservatives understand this idea of religious liberty and having religious convictions. Absolutely. Andrea, did you want to jump in before we return back to the phones?
I just wanted to add that, yes, Ben Carson, is Christian and he, does in one bottle say that, you know, I'm religious, and he's an outsider, but an outsider to whom? Remember, the Republicans have to still sell Ben Carson to everybody else. And really it seems what Ben Carson is doing is just selling the Republicans' idea about their ideas around race to themselves. Mm. Nobody else seems to be really convinced about Ben Carson, especially after everything that he has said around race. Mm. So, you know, I think everybody else kind of feels like good luck to him. If he gets it, yay. If not, probably more than likely the rest of the United States probably won't be voting for him anyway. But, you know, hey, it, kind of like Michael Steele and even more like a Colin Powell, I guess people are feeling that, yay, I'm glad he's around, but do we take him seriously? Not really. Hmm. I think that Colin Powell is actually taken still more seriously, and he's long gone out of the political picture than Ben Carson. So again, I also think that Ben Carson, he's actually in that shadow of Colin Powell. When people really think of a Black Republican that's respected, it's still Colin Powell.
Right, right. And it's interesting because it feels as though the Republicans are searching for their own Barack Obama.
Mm-hmm.
And that Ben Carson might be that for them, because he is, as Dr. Cromer was saying, he is that intellectual. And that's one of the tidbits that was always referenced when Barack Obama was ascending to the level of presidency, that we could speak to the fact of how well educated he was and how he was this intellectual. He was a smart man. And so Ben Carson becomes that for us in some respects for the Republican Party.
But again, but basically he's the kind of their Black echo chamber. The rest of us are still not convinced of his intellectual capability. Yes, he's a neurosurgeon. Yes, you have to be smart to be a neurosurgeon. But when everything else sounds pretty foolish, we kind of wonder, we either at best say, stick to neurosurgery, or maybe you should be a little bit more educated on other issues.
Okay. Well, Theo is on the line with us, and he actually wants to offer support for Dr. Carson, so I want to hear his voice. Theo.
Well, yeah, it's not so much support for Dr. Carson, but one question that I think we ought to get out, too, is did the Democrats give a lot of support to Al Sharpton? I mean, did you consider him electable?
I think that you're talking apples and oranges. Just because Al Sharpton is Black doesn't mean that everybody's going for him. I think for me, when I look at Ben Carson and people like Herman Cain and even, again, Colin Powell, you're talking about variations of blackness. And I think what the problem with Ben Carson is he becomes so singular in white conservatives' minds when there's still a plethora of black folks. And it kind of goes back to that Key and Peele sketch where there's a gathering of black Republicans, but they're all exactly alike. They applaud the same way. They wear the same outfit. They have the same dad jeans. They all wear glasses. They all have that male pattern balding. And the,
that's
and
a
the
horrible the, visual, I just want to mention.
And the end of the joke is some guy comes in, he's like, somebody's white wife is outside, and they all get up. And someone says, is it Emily? He says, I just know the wife is white. And that's the end of the skit. But still, what I'm getting at is, it's like the Republicans keep putting on singularities of blackness. I think that's where the cynicism and almost the kind of cravenness of how Ben Carson plays into the larger idea around the politics and blackness and having this black man as president. It's like you're a neurosurgeon. You're not an intellectual giant. Sorry, but you're a neurosurgeon, and that's good. But what else are you? What else do you offer to the public discourse besides the usual general talking points of the Republican Party?
Okay, Dr. Cromer, do you want to respond?
Yeah, and I think that's actually a really interesting point. So for me, as somebody who studies state politics primarily, I think if Republicans actually want to really address the issue of diversity within their party, they really need to start with not so much running a Ben Carson, perhaps, in a presidential primary, but really start with getting more people of color elected to the statewide office. So at the state legislative level, so those people can then run for Congress. And so when it comes time to start pulling people or tapping people to run,
choose the random neurosurgeon.
No, it's not the random neurosurgeon. It's the senator. It's the member of the House. It's a governor. And that, I think, is really, when we talk about addressing the issues of diversity in the Republican Party, it really has to start at the ground up, not so much the top down.
Catalina,
interesting. I'm so sorry.
No, that's okay, Andrea, please.
I was going to say, and I find it so interesting because actually the Republicans have it's basically a 100-year plan of how they're going to, from the ground up, take over everything from the state politics up to the Supreme Court and the presidency. So within that, I'm kind of surprised that diversity was not part of that plan. But then I kind of wonder, was diversity going to be part of the plan? Or did diversity become a thing when it seemed like people like Barack Obama were presenting this new moving picture in politics? It's like they always had a plan. They always had a game, a long game, always. Not always, but at least in the last 20, 30, 40 years, they've always had a long game. So this idea that they could not think of diversity on that ground level, it surprises me. It surprises me, but it doesn't astound me. Okay. Maybe I should say it like that.
Catalina, you wanted to say?
Yeah, there's a couple of things. First of all, both parties always had strategies, and we didn't see the exodus of black people from the Republican Party to the Democratic Party until after the Southern Strategy. And so if the plan was being formulated then, diversity wasn't something that needed to be planned for at that juncture, because we were traditionally, as black people, who understood, I guess, the intellectual ones, that it was the Republicans that freed the slaves. In Maryland, if you look at it more locally, that was the first party that made the first black elected statewide in Michael Steele. So they were trying to. And then once we got, especially in Maryland and even more so in Baltimore, indoctrinated to this theory that if you were black, you were supposed to be Democrat and you should only look at Democrats, it's very difficult for them to be able to handpick someone to support and try to raise from the bottom up, because it will get you shunned in your own community to even be Republican. I'm not Republican, as I said numerous times and Ernest alluded to, but the fact that I just worked for one in 2002 and 2006 has made me shunned in portions of my own community for the last 13 plus years. You look at Eugene Craig, who's a dear friend of mine who I've known since he was 18 years old when he was president of the Young Republicans.
And also often on the show to represent
the show. Yes. watched the VMAs last week, filed with the FEC, and created a PAC called Ready for Kanye after Kanye West comments about running for president in 2020. There is a space and a place for the not singular black conservative. What has to happen is, A, the Republicans have to accept them, but then we also, as black people, have to be willing to hear them out and not discount them because of the R. I think what I find most interesting about Carson and Trump is they both are very narcissistic. Well, when Carson talks about all of these things that black people need to do, I was raised in Baltimore City Central Committee. I never saw him come to a meeting. I never saw him try to turn himself into an asset through his access or his knowledge or his wealth to the Republican Party here locally. So I see it as an opportunistic move because you've retired and you've left Hopkins and you want to make sure people still want to talk to you. And there are going to be other brain surgeons emerging the longer you stay out of the fray. I don't know that this is about America so much. I don't know that this is about improving our quality of life and the American dream so much as he just wants to still be relevant.
Okay. Okay. Donna is calling us from Baltimore. If we can hear her comment, and then we're going to talk about Kim Davis. Donna, welcome. Good morning.
Yeah. How are you?
I'm well, thank you. Thanks for joining us. Your comment. Donna?
Hi. Well, good morning. I just wanted to state that I believe that the state and local government ranks of government. Hello?
Hello. We're here.
Okay.
Donna?
Yes.
Please, we're waiting for your comment.
Okay, I was just stating that state and local government ranks of government that people will come through will allow us to examine our candidates for a time.
Okay.
Okay.
Dr. Cromer, would you like to respond to that?
Sure. Again, I think it is really important. It does establish at least a voting record for mm-hmm. people. So that's the kind of wild card with anybody who's an outsider candidate is there is just no telling how they stand on a whole plethora of different policy issues, both at the domestic and international level. And so if that's what the caller's point is, Right. Yes, having from both Republicans and Democrats candidates who come up through the ranks, it is nice for voters to have at least a concrete voting record in which to establish their policy positions
and have a sense of who the person is.
Right. So not just what they say, but also what they do.
Right. Absolutely. Absolutely. I want to turn very quickly because I want to make sure that we do hear our panelists' voices on a more contemporary issue that just happened last week. And I'm referring to when Kentucky clerk Kim Davis was jailed for actually refusing to issue marriage licenses to gay and lesbian couples. And she was also released earlier this week. And many of you have probably seen the stories or at least seen the pictures with the caption of her and Mike Huckabee coming out of jail, feeling victorious and believing that this was seen as a win for religious liberty movement, which, of course, means we've also been hearing and seeing examples of co-opting the language of the civil rights movement, including how her actions have been likened to those of Rosa Parks in particular and others. So I want to give some time to our panelists to offer their perspective, but I also wanted to read a quote very quickly from a political article by John Culhane, whose article was simply titled Kim Davis is No Rosa Parks, where he simply starts by saying that, yes, it appears that she is able to play this martyr role, but contrary to her, and I'm reading direct quote, to her own self-aggrandizing description, she is no Rosa Parks. In fact, she is quite the opposite. While Parks was a private citizen defying what she knew to be the law, Davis, on the other hand, is a public official who is charged with following the law. She's Rosa Parks' bus driver denying a service to the public. So, Dr. Cromer, I would love to hear your immediate reaction to that or even just Kim Davis herself.
So I think my reaction really is more of the Huckabee-Kim Davis kind of connection. It really shows what it looks like in a Republican primary in this Trump world where we see candidates doing anything, attaching themselves to any issue to just get a little bit of airtime. I think it was a competition at one point between Huckabee and Cruz to latch onto this, to be the person to stand with Kim Davis. And to me, it's amazing. This is an gay marriage is an election issue that now is, to me, is dead. And it's dead if you look at public opinion polls. The majority of Americans now support gay marriage. That number is only going to rise if you look at it among millennials. This is not an issue that anybody really needs to attach themselves to, especially if they have actual any real hopes of running in a general election. But Huckabee and Cruz and the like, they need to do something to get some airspace to even get on that debate stage in the next few months.
Well, Catalina, I want to hear your response to this because, you know, it has come out that Kim Davis is, in fact, a registered Democrat. But Mike Huckabee, who we know is quite the conservative, also has a background as a minister and is very much a conservative Republican. So I'd like to hear how you rationalize or how you visualize the fact that he could attach himself to someone like Kim Davis on this particular issue.
Because the evangelical Christian Republican is the same as the evangelical Christian Democrat.
Okay.
Damn.
So they're one and the same. And, you know, the hypocrisy that, and that's what when I'm talking to people all year round, we talk on the air, that elected officials have jobs where they can't be fired but once every 4 or 2 years, depending on their term. And she is the epitome of what I've been speaking over the airwaves for years. This woman is refusing to do her job. And she cannot be fired. She can be jailed for contempt, but she can't be fired. We have to wait for another election. And the hypocrisy that she would choose to take this stance. And I've been reading in these different conservative evangelical groups because I go in the Fox Threads to see what they're saying.
So do I.
This is a woman who's been married 3 times, who had her children by another man while she was married to another one. And do you know what their defense of her is? She wasn't saved until after the last time she got married.
Wow.
And so they don't have to judge her for how she lived, and they can stand with her for her judging other people because clearly they've never met any same-sex couples that also believe in Jesus. And I think that is just mind-blowing. That's the part that's mind-blowing to me. It's not, she's not Rosa Parks. She's not working hard and keeping her nose to the ground. She has basically a Maury Povich kind of life. And now she's becoming a hero of some sort, but to whom and for what?
Right. And we also know that, I mean, even Rosa Parks being that seemingly martyr was very strategic, right, in the civil rights movement. That it wasn't about, oh, she was just tired that day and sat down. That there was very much a strategy at play to make this happen, and they needed to choose the right person in order for it to happen. And so Rosa Parks was the selected or chosen one for that particular role, whereas Kim Davis just didn't want to do her job.
And I think what it gets to, if I have to look at it from a biblical perspective, and I think this is where the left, and they're being so busy to shame Kim Davis about being from the South and having her 4 or 5 husbands and kids that are not by the husband she says she's married to. We need to say to Kim, by your own Bible, you are supposed to render unto Caesar what belonged to Caesar. Marrying those same-sex couples falls under Caesar's purview. That's your job. You need to do that.
Right, right.
And if you want to sit down and talk about, well, I feel that marrying homosexuals, blah, 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 blah. It's like, well, Kim, technically you should be stoned to death right about now because of the adultery that you committed. You probably are wearing some fabrics that are probably against everything in the New Testament. And you probably eat shellfish and cloven-hoofed creatures, right? So shouldn't you be dead by now? I mean, that's, if we use their logic against them, then we can actually kind of sit there and be, look how the foolishness and the ludicrousness of what this woman is trying to say, but use them on their own terms. And I think where the left went wrong at was that we don't know how to speak on those terms to them to be able to say, Kim Davis is just wrong on these levels.
Right, right. Can I, Gary is holding on the line and wants to interject a comment about Kim Davis. Good morning, Gary.
I'm on here. I'll talk to you guys later. Hi. I'll talk to you in a little bit. Hi. I just wanted to simply say, to morph into the situation as it pertains to Ben Carson and Kim Davis, is a certain negative religiosity, which I find abhorrent, because I remember reading Gifted Hands. And I remember that when Dr. Ben Carson was a teenager, he went to stab another young man, but his blade broke on the belt buckle of the young man he went to stab.
Mm-hmm.
And so he would have had a completely different life had that blade not broken on that young man's belt buckle.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, not to be redundant as it pertains to Ben Carson, but that's a very insular environment when you're a famous neurosurgeon at Johns Hopkins. And so to like kind of bridge the gap between Kim Davis and Dr. Ben Carson, this religiosity is dangerous. And even though people have called this a Christian country, I guarantee you if people today, including Kim Davis, were to be thrown in the arena, into the Coliseum with the lions back in the day when the Christians were really kind of like in some ways the equivalent of people who follow Islam today being totally demonized, et cetera, their perspectives would be very, very different. And, you know, I'm glad that you allowed me to speak to you guys in the audience, and I'll just take your comments off there. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Gary. And that's a perfect segue to hear from the voices of our panelists before we wrap up this hour. So I want to start with Andrea to share any concluding remarks or even a response that you may want to offer to Gary.
I, in a sense, agree with Gary because I think both Kim Davis and Ben Carson are cynical examples of how the Republicans, today's Republicans, are using race and gender in order to do these cheap ploys in their waging a culture war. I mean, this is what all this is about. Ben Carson on race is a form of a culture war. He's a soldier in the culture war in that sense, as is Kim Davis. But unfortunately, as we are moving in this country, we are, I do believe, thanks to people like the Black Lives Matter movement, we are definitely, to use the cliche now, bending the arc towards justice.
Okay.
And that's just how it needs to happen.
Okay, Catalina.
I agree with Gary's call as well. It's just from a strategy and a field perspective, it makes for good media, for good radio and TV, but when it gets down to it, people in the field, when you're knocking on doors and making phone calls, ask hard questions, they expect real answers. And neither of these things have substance. And I think that this is where the Republican Party has missed the boat every time since W, in understanding that you can sensationalize things all day, but substance wins.
Okay. Dr. Cromer.
I think at the end of the day, being religiously conservative and religious does matter to a large cross-section of voters. But really, when you start to break it down, it's the economy that matters. It's unemployment that matters. So while things like abortion might make a difference to some social conservatives or positions on something like gay marriage might matter, at the end of the day, when it comes down to the ballot box, people want to hear policy perspectives that are going to do things like alleviate poverty. They're going to improve the economy for everybody and increase the number of job availability here in the United States. So that's what Ben Carson will have to become better versed in if he wants to appeal, if he makes it somehow through the primary, if he wants to appeal to a broad base of U.S. voters.
All right. Well, thank you. I want to again acknowledge our all-women's panel today by thanking Andrea Plaid of the Feminist Wire, Kirkus Review, and Twin Cities Daily Planet, as well as Catalina Byrd, media consultant and political strategist, as well as Dr. Malia Cromer from the Sarah T. Hughes Field Politics Center at Goucher College. Thank you so much for joining us today. Hope you enjoy the hour. I'm Kimberly Moffitt, sitting in for Mark Steiner this morning. Coming up when we return on The Mark Steiner Show, it's a new episode of Sound Bites, our weekly look at food and agriculture. We begin the hour with a look at organic food, how we define it, and why it is currently being recalled at such high rates. And Mark interviews Ruth Tam, web producer of the Kojo Namdi Show and contributor to She the People, about her recent article for the Washington Post, quoted, "How it feels when white people shame your culture's food, then make it trendy. Don't go away and enjoy your day."